Like many of you, I've been doing a lot of marching since November of 2016. It's been wearing on the soles of my feet, of my shoes, and on this soul as well. Music inspires me. The chants that accompany the march on the streets inspire me. The simple message that anchors me away from all the distractions of a daily life to what's truth, what's justice, and what matters. As many of you know, I am a big mental health advocate, and some of the quote-unquote marching has been on behalf of individuals who experience mental illness in their lives. It took me a couple of weeks ago to the Tri-City Medical Center, where we were alarmed and advocating strongly with a message that the Tri-City Medical Center, a public hospital, should not be closing its behavioral health unit and crisis stabilization units. That's 30 beds out of this San Diego region taken offline for inpatient residential care of those with serious psychiatric illnesses. The trail of how the Tri-City Medical Center board of directors or trustees, elected individuals, I should add, got to that place is a little bit muddy, not really clear, and probably not really just. But what was clear at that meeting, of the special board meeting of the Tri-City Medical Health Center, was the voice of the unions, both the individuals who work there at Tri-City, who were advocating to keep the units open, both for their jobs and also for the service to the community. It was alarming to me to find out that the psychiatrist, a lead psychiatrist who works full-time at the hospital, even though the crisis stabilization unit had closed, was seeing patients in a fast-track sort of whatever system they invented in a linen closet. The psychiatrist of the psychiatric unit for Tri-City Medical Center is seeing patients in a linen closet, much to the surprise of people who are accustomed to going for linens there. What struck me was there was a number of people there for grassroots advocacy. And in that room, we also met people like Molly Woods Drake, who is a guest who will be speaking just following me today. People who not only believe in union organizing and the betterment of justice for workers in our world, but also who were advocating for proper care, proper policy, and the democratic principles that we so believe in with the Tri-City Medical Center staff and trustees. I went away from it with sort of a different reflection on union. In the opening song, we heard about which side are you on? And in some way, union organizing and the word union has come to mean sort of an us versus them. It's not really the truth. And the first definition for union, don't you hate it when people stand up here and give you a definition? The first definition is about partnerships, about significant and serious partnerships. That's what a union is. Union of our spirits here has caused us to remain. Anybody get married to that song? Yeah. The union of our spirits. The union of our spirits brings us to think about things like the joy that our family brings, the ultimate worth that we can bring as partners, that each of us is completed by the other, and only through the intimate integration of our personal lives can the full spectrum of selfhood be realized. In other words, I'm not the true self I can be until I'm partnering in an intimate and personal union with others. Union as an association formed by people with a common interest or good, a workers' union, an employees' union, is critical to the justice we find in our society. I want to just kind of give you a few headlines. These are recent headlines. On June 27th, the Supreme Court overruled its 40-year-old decision regarding non-union member fair share fees. That was a case that was brought over $45 by a non-union member who benefited from all of the privileges and benefits that are granted a union in collective bargaining. How about this one? More seniors, 85 and up, are looking for work or working. It's the highest rate on record, but then on the opposite end of the spectrum, more individuals under 30 are staying away at rates not seen in the 60s and 70s. You know, there's really no doubt we all believe that workers, that unions benefit working families, but since the 70s, what I just cited, what happened at the Supreme Court, and the numbers of support that the union's ability to support good wages is declining because it's becoming more and more difficult to bargain. And working conditions have been undermined for our collective bargaining. Traditionally, non-union employees need to keep wages high in order to compete with union jobs. That would be non-union employers need to keep wages high because unions are strong and can command higher wages. But now, it's just the opposite. Union jobs are being forced to accept lower wages and conditions to remain competitive in an economy that's dominated by non-union companies. It's become essentially a race to the bottom for hardworking Americans. There are many. In fact, I would guess that just about all of you in this amphitheater this morning have benefited either personally, directly as union members, by your fathers, by your partners who were union members. My union, Heart Union, and my partner personally made it possible for me to be an entrepreneur because there was security in a union wage. Safer working condition, better wages and benefits. 79% of unionized workers receive health insurance compared to only 49% of non-union workers. Remember the 40-hour work week and overtime that came to us only by unionizing back at the turn of the century? According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, union wages are 27% greater. 83% of workers receive paid sick leave compared to only 62% of non-union workers. We might add to that individual health care workers. Supporting working men and women and efforts to strengthen collective bargaining endures our economy, works for middle-class families, not just for shareholders and corporate bottom lines. You know, it was striking to me that within a week of the Janus decision of the Supreme Court, there was, well, arguably a little bit of good news. A worker shortage, agricultural worker shortage in California has led to a contract and pledge of cooperation between California's top leafy green grower, that's the Darigo brothers, and the United Farm Workers. However, what might be key to that agreement is aging, being really tired of fighting. On behalf of the United Farm Workers president and Arturo Rodriguez, these individuals engaged in personal, this kind of union, diplomacy, seeking to relieve the economic pressures that included a shrinking labor force. It's going to affect 1,500 workers. And the exciting and good news is the health insurance plan will cover families, and it will be fully paid for by the companies, according to the RFK plan, which was established for farm workers. It's family security. The employees covered by this agreement will receive hourly and productivity pay hikes, making them amongst the industry's highest paid workers. They're going to get pay for personal vehicle use. Yes, individuals who use their work for their job are going to get reimbursed with a travel time allowance of 50 cents per mile. Now, I might remind you that's 5 cents or 10% less than most of us who get if our employers are complying with the federal suggested compensation rate. But it is good news. It's security. In fact, some of the agreement that the labor union hammered out was to forego a little bit of wage increases and bargain really hard to get that insurance coverage, because we all know it takes one or two visits and any amount of increase in your salary for a year is gone. So why was this agreement struck and why this year? Well, once again, let me emphasize a reduction in workers. There aren't enough agricultural workers. In fact, millions of dollars in losses by the D'Arrigo brothers is being experienced because they've been plowing under fields because of a persistent shortage of workers. In fact, here's the words. That investment will hopefully translate into people wanting to work here the whole season. Let's pay them more money. Let's show them their value. It's all about attraction and retention. Both parties felt compelled to work out a solution. So what I want to say here today to close with is that my soul and my souls get tired and weak. But if we are enforcing our UU principles about justice, economic justice, worker justice, social justice, mental health justice, we need to stand beside our workers and our unions. We need to stand beside them, unions of all kinds, environmental activists, scientists, labor, families, musicians. And we can start by standing beside the healthcare workers at Tri-City Medical Center. I'm very, very honored to introduce you to Molly Woods Brooks, who I met at Tri-City. Thank you, Molly.
Thank you, Wenda, for the opportunity and invitation to come and speak to you all today, and thank you guys for having me here. As Wenda mentioned, I work for SEIU, Service Employees International Union, United Healthcare Workers West, which represents about 100,000 healthcare workers here in California. Specifically, I work as the representative for Tri-City Medical Center in Oceanside. I've been with them for about 9 years, but it's important that I share a little bit more about my upbringing in the labor movement because while I've worked for 9 years with the union, my lifetime has really been in the labor movement. Wenda talked about the United Farm Workers. My father, Reverend Jim Drake, began his career in labor with the United Farm Workers movement. He was Cesar Chavez's right-hand man. And for those of you that were around during the 60s and did not eat table grapes for a long time, my father was the one who led that boycott and organized that boycott. And so he, in many ways, I obviously was not alive during those times. But, you know, that is where my father began his career. And later my mother, who is here, would end up also, she grew up in Arizona and would end up in California also working for the farm workers movement. And that's where she met my father. In the late 70s, they would leave California, go to Mississippi, and take on the task of organizing woodcutters into unions and making sure that they had the opportunity to come together and create a better life for themselves. And that's where I was born, in Jackson, Mississippi, in 1981. And shortly thereafter, we would go to Texas, to the Rio Grande Valley, where my dad would become a community organizer there, bring running water to the communities that were low income and suffering along the borders. And eventually, I would end up in North Jersey when my father took a job in the South Bronx. And so while my parents never spoke to me, and said, like, this is the path you should follow, equality and justice and your privilege should be used, and, you know, it's a great responsibility, they instilled that in me with their life. I grew up in the churches of the South Bronx, and it was there that I realized that there really was no difference between me and a person of color. I never saw that as being a difference. But I also grew up in conservative North Jersey, where I constantly heard the difference of people that are white and people that are black. I'm Mexican, and I would hear many times about, you know, derogatory terms around about Mexicans. my mother, you know, it's like she had same-sex couple friends, and I knew nothing, there was nothing strange to me about this. It was just what I grew up seeing. And so for many, you know, I grew up knocking doors as a young child. I remember being in New York City and going through the tall apartment buildings and leaving leaflets outside for people to vote for certain candidates. I really had no idea what I was doing. I kind of just went wherever my parents took me. And in 1991, my mom took me to the labor march in Washington, D.C., which was about 500,000 people that were there in about 100 degrees heat. And I ended the march by throwing up on the Capitol Grill restaurant. And I said, I'm done. Like, I am done with the labor movement. I am done with these marches. I am now old enough. I'm a teenager. I'm making my decision. And for many years, I just became that, like most teenagers, I was a selfish, self-involved teenager, and I stepped away from the movement. And I eventually went to college, and I got an English degree, and thought that I would teach English. And, you know, I say my parents, while they touched thousands and thousands of lives with their work, I think mine was touched more than any other, because when I finished school, all I knew is that I wanted to help people. And I didn't really know what to do. And the third favorite community organizer in my life, Barack Obama, was running for president at that time. And so I decided to volunteer for his campaign. And it was during that that I met a lot of other young folks who were being swept up in this movement. And when he won, I said to my mother, I want to come work for the union. And she was like, well, I'll tell him you're my daughter, but I don't support the decision. I think my mom knew, you know, this isn't a job, it's a cause that you sign up for. And I watched my parents spend their entire life working on this cause, which often meant that they weren't able to be around for their family obligations. And for a long time, I resented that until I started working for the labor movement. And I realized the cause of helping people who are working two jobs, three jobs every day and are never able to be around for their family obligations was far more important than my parents showing up for my soccer game. And so for the last 9 years, I've had the honor of working for the same cause as my parents and understanding them in a way that I never did before, but also understanding my privilege. You know, it's like, we're all here because we live in North County. I can't imagine more privilege than that. And so every day, you know, it's like my job is to go out and use that privilege. As they say, it's a great responsibility to help someone else. And for the last 9 years, I've got to do that with SEIU. And so a little bit about the work that we do. I started working in the Bay Area. I was in the organizing department, which meant that I went all over the country to try to organize workers that were non-union working in hospitals into the union. I'd say the most remarkable and unfortunate campaign that I was on was in rural Pennsylvania, where I would meet workers who were certified nursing assistants. They are the ones that bring you your food, you know, clean you when you're dirty, really are the ones that are the most hands-on. And I would talk to these men and women, and they would tell me that how they had 30 patients a day on two different floors. And so if you're a patient, you're not receiving the right type of care, because if you're pressing your button but your nurse is on the other floor, you're never going to get the right type of care. And if you're one of these workers, you yourself are never getting your breaks. You are not being paid a livable wage, and you leave every day exhausted. And then for most of them, they're going to another job because they're not making enough money to be able to afford the life that they are trying to live there. And so I would talk to these workers about our contracts here in California, where we have the Kaiser contract, which is the strongest contract in the country when it comes to healthcare. And I would tell them, these people have fully paid family health insurance. They have pensions. They have a patient care group where they can go and talk about how to provide better care for their patients. And they could not imagine that this was fathomable. I would bring the contract and put them in front of them. And even though they could see it, they couldn't imagine that that could ever be their life. And so between that unimaginability and their fear of what would happen if they stepped up and said, yes, I'm going to vote for the union, they chose not to join the union. And so these workers still continue to make probably extremely, you know, it's like minimum wage. Their patients are still suffering. And we continue, as Wenda had said, we're racing to the bottom, not just in how we're treating our workers, but how we're providing care, not just in healthcare, but, you know, whether it's in hospitality or any of these industries, we are not giving the best type of, you know, produce, you know, we're not producing the way that we should be because it's incapable for these workers to do so. And so that, you know, it's like for 5 years I worked in the organizing department, and, you know, my mom's words kept ringing, you know, I'll tell them you're my daughter, but I don't support this. And eventually I said, I'm going to just take a job as a rep and have one hospital because I don't want to continue living in hotels for the rest of my life, and I came down to San Diego and began working as the rep at Tri-City Medical Center. And so I've been here for 4 years, and like Wenda said, you know, we're in constant battle. Tri-City is a public hospital. They're struggling financially, as most hospitals are, because the healthcare industry is struggling right now. But what I will say, you know, is that I feel very fortunate to work for a union that thinks outside of the box. We are not, well, I feel right now I am constantly on defense from the current administration and everything that's happening. I do know that we are constantly standing up, and we're coming up with new innovative ways to be on the offense. And recently I had the honor of hearing Cecile Richards speak. She came and spoke at our executive board leadership meeting, and she had reminded us that while these may be the people in power, they are not the ones with the power. We are the ones with the power. And the way that we use our power most effectively at UHW is through ballot measures. And so California, as many know, is a ballot measure state. And there's about 16 other states in the country that are ballot measure states. And so we have created an organization which is called the Fairness Project. And this is unions coming together with other organizations. And we are taking back the power by using ballot measures, because our vote is so much stronger than any organization's money and any politician that's sitting in office and making decisions. And so coming up, you know, we have already passed minimum wage in states like Washington State and other areas. And what we'll be doing on this ballot is passing more minimum wage, paid sick leave for places where people don't have, in states where they don't have that, making sure that we're expanding the Medicare for all in certain states where governors have decided to not expand Medi-Cal. And so Wenda had talked about, you know, it's like this partnership and this us versus them, and that people hear unions and they just think like, oh, Jimmy Hoffa, and they're only, you know, out for their own good. Trust me, I, you know, it's like I hear it all the time when I say I work for a union. People first are like, what? Like, union organizers still exist? And the second, they're like, you don't look like a crunchy union organizer. You don't fit the bill. And then the third is, like, I don't like unions. Unions take care of the lazy people. Unions are greedy, and they're only out for their own. And what I can say is that the union that I'm honored to work for, we're not. You know that there's a lot of gray area, and there's a lot that happens in other unions. But unions have always been about the intersectionality. You can't have racial justice. You cannot have LGBTQI justice. You can't have immigration justice. You can't have any of these without economic justice. And so if we don't come together as partners in different organizations and realize that by lifting up people that are in unions, as Wenda had said, we are lifting up everybody else. And then by lifting up everybody else, we can then fight for all of those other issues, that it will never happen. And so the only thing that separates labor unions from anything else is the reality that these people are legally allowed to form their unions, and therefore they have more collective bargaining strength to take the resources from these large organizations. Kaiser is a billion-dollar nonprofit. So they're a nonprofit that's making billions of dollars every year. Their CEO makes about $9 million a year at the nonprofit. And they are saying to their workers currently, we're in contract negotiations, we don't want to keep paying your free health insurance. We don't want to give you the raises that you deserve. But if we're able to continue to fight them and take this from them and use ballot measures and use our collective bargaining strength, then we continue to raise the healthcare wages for everybody else so that the non-union, like Scripps and Sharp, have to remain competitive. And this raises the floor for everybody else. And so, you know, it's like, I know because I see behind the scenes that unions have never been just about unions and just about themselves. Just the same, you know, and we cannot win if it's only unions fighting for themselves. The only way that the farm workers were able to get a contract back in the days of the Great Boycott were because people across the country said, I am also going to stand in solidarity with these farm workers and boycott the grapes. And then it became table lettuce, and they were able to have a strong footing. And so the only way now that unions will be able to come back from what's happening, to touch a little bit on the Janus decision that happened in the Supreme Court, this is something that has been trying, you know, it's like the right wing is trying to take advantage or go after unions for years. We won 3 years ago because Scalia died, but that was the first time that this should have gone through. When it went through, this month. The reason it's happening is because unions, one, they're the best way to take power away from large corporations and put it into the working class. But two, we're one of the largest PACs when it comes to politics. And so if a political group wants to take power away and make sure that they're continually electing the people in that are going to take care of large corporations, the best way to do that is create a sweeping law that is now going to say you are no longer mandated to pay union dues, and you can make that decision yourself, but you are mandated to continue to provide the same type of services to these people. And so it's really just about taking away financial power from unions and nothing about saying to workers, we want to give you the right to work. What it really is you can work for less money, you can work for less benefits, and you could work for less respect and go back to the days like before when we didn't have unions at all. And so this is for public sectors, which is about 37% of our workforce. These are our teachers, our police officers, our firemen. And if we think that this only affects them, we're wrong. Because if you have children who are going to school and their teachers' unions are weakened, you're going to have larger class sizes. If you no longer are going to have the same type of pensions for police officers and firemen, then you're no longer going to have the same type of safety provided to you in your communities. And so again, it continuously comes back to the intersectionality of that. If we have to take care of our brothers and sisters. And you know, what I will say is working for a union has allowed me to see this in a way I never did before. Like I said, I was raised believing in social justice. I didn't really know how to go out there and fight the fight, but this gives me the avenue to do so in a way that I can march and I do all of those things. I'm, you know, part of a lot of different progressive groups, but working for a labor union, as I see every day, how we have the power because we have the numbers and we have the resources in a way other organizations don't to really create real change. Governor Brown signed the $15 an hour bill into law about a year and a half ago. When he had been asked to do this time and time again, he said, no, I'm not going to do this. No, I'm not going to do this. SEIU UHW filed a ballot measure, which would require the passing of $15 minimum wage. It was far more aggressive than the governor wanted it to be, and therefore he signed the bill into law. And so this is what we have to do. We have to keep putting the pressure on our politicians to do the right thing, because if given the opportunity, they're not going to do it on their own. Give me one second. What I'll say, you know, it's like the call to action, because as a union organizer, I never just come and say this is what's happening, but there's always, you know, people have to act. There's a plan to win. And like I said, you know, we're using ballot measures. One of the big things that we're taking on right now is the dialysis industry. And so if anybody knows someone who's on dialysis, they either go to one of two places. They go to DaVita or they go to Fresenius. It's a $4 billion profit industry, and they have a monopoly on dialysis, which means if you're a dialysis patient and you're not receiving good care at one of these two places, you continue to go to one of these two places because there's nowhere else to go. They own 80% of the market here in California and across the country. And so workers at DaVita and Fresenius have come to the union and they've said, we want to form a union. How do we do this? And they've been working with our union for the last year to try to do this. Many of them have lost their jobs. You know, again, this is a $4 billion profit industry, and they do not want anyone coming and taking their money or having a seat at the table. And so workers have been fired. But during the process, we hear these horror stories. Really, what they want is to take better care of their patients. They're not even saying, like, give us more money. They're saying, we have patients who are dying while sitting in the seats because there's too many of them, and one starts coding and another one starts coding, and I have to decide whose life is more important in that time. And so these patients are dying, and the workers are coming up and saying, we want to have a better way to take care of them. And what we have done is we have created a community division, which are patients and workers that are non-union coming together to take on the dialysis industry. So last week, we actually passed a bill through the state, and we're waiting for the governor to see if he'll sign it. And what it says is that these industries cannot charge more than 25% of what it costs to actually give care. And if they do, it has to go back into the patient care, and it has to go back into the workers, and it has to go into making sure that they're giving better care. But also stay tuned, because we are Prop 8 is our proposition. The union has filed and put on the ballot for November. And this is saying the same exact thing, because we know that the governor might not do the right thing. And so we say the power is in the people, and we'll give them the opportunity to take away the power from these large organizations. The other way we're fighting is California, of the 50 states, is the third lowest when it comes to Medi-Cal reimbursement rates. So if we know someone on Medi-Cal, we also know that they're not getting the same type of care that myself as a private insurance patient is getting. People on Medi-Cal can't get the appointments the way that somebody with private insurance can. And of the 12 million people on Medi-Cal in California, 8 million of them are Latinos. And so what we recognize as a union is that if an entire class is being discriminated against and is getting different care, this becomes a civil rights violation. And so our union has filed a civil rights lawsuit against the state of California, saying that you have to do better by patients. While it's for specifically this group of Latino that the class action has been filed against, obviously everyone will benefit from the increase of Medi-Cal. And it's not just the patients. I've met many doctors who say, I can't take Medi-Cal because I will go out of business. Because you get 30 cents on the dollar for the cost of giving the care. And so if you're a doctor and you're treating someone, it costs $1,000 and you only get $300, your business is gonna go under. And so, you know, it's like, again, this, I just bring this up because it comes back to the idea that unions are thinking solely about themselves. And it goes to the definition that unions are about partnership. Many of these things won't ever help our workers in the way that they're going to get more money in their pocket, that they're going to get better health care. It doesn't improve their contracts. But what it does is it lifts up health care for California, and it lifts up all working class in California, which in turn helps everybody in California. And it's not just California. My mom, who's here, she works for SEIU, the International, and I'm sure everyone has heard about the Fight for the 15. Fight for 15 was started by SEIU. We get no members out of this. We don't get members paying union dues to the union, but yet we are financing this campaign to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour because it is the right thing to do, and because unions believe in justice as being the right thing to do, and that the power that we need will come one way or another. These are people that are working in fast food restaurants that are walking out and just saying, I'm going to fight with no protection. I'm going to have my job back in that place. And so, you know, I'll close with, it's one of my favorite quotes, and it's by Frederick Douglass, and it's a lot of fighting. I'm exhausted too. You know, it's like November 2016, I got on a plane and I went to India because I knew I needed to go and recharge. And I knew I was so angry, and I knew I had so much hate in me, and I knew I wasn't going to make any difference with that anger or hate. And so I went to India for 10 days and I meditated and I prayed and I came back to the place that I know and that I was raised to know, where I can make a difference. And that's from love, and that's from nonviolence. But I know that even with love and nonviolence, we have to fight, and there's going to be conflict. And so Frederick Douglass, he said, those who profess to favor freedom and yet depreciate agitation are people who want crops without plowing the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the roar of its many waters. The struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. And so every day I feel like I am uncomfortable, where I am having to get out of, I am not comfortable speaking in front of people, you know, but it's like I also know that there are people who are struggling because they've been separated from their families. There are people that are going to work tomorrow on Labor Day when it should be a national holiday, and they are going to go work two jobs because they have to put food on the table. And there are people that are struggling every day in discomfort. And so if I'm not uncomfortable, then I know that I am not doing enough. I didn't choose the life in the labor movement. Like I said, I joke that I was the test tube union organizer baby. I didn't have much choice simply because it was ingrained in me. I have three older brothers, and they didn't choose the path that I chose. I just think that, you know, nothing happens by mistake, and I was always meant to be on this path. And tomorrow, you know, in closing, you know, as I said, nothing happens by mistake. Tomorrow's Labor Day, and it's also, 17 years since my father passed away. And there are no mistakes. That I met Wenda, and she said to me, can you come and speak on behalf of the labor movement and the work that was done? My father was a reverend by title, but he never held, you know, a congregation. It was just he had gone to school and got that title and then ended up falling in with the farm workers and began his true, his congregation was service. You know, that was what he was meant to do. And it's my honor, and I know my dad, you know, could not be more proud to know that I do the work that I do today and that I'm up here speaking in front of you guys and spreading the word of what we get to do. And so I will just close with a quote from my dad, who was writing a book before he passed away, and he didn't have an opportunity to finish that book. But when he did die, he had written about why he organizes and the purpose for that, and I relate to it to this day, and I hope that others will get something from it. "Today I organize, I must organize, because I want integrity both for my family network and for the world in which I live. Objectively, the lessons of the IIF, which is the Industrial Areas Foundation, who he was working for, tell me that I organize because relatedness in public life, the very survival of our society, and the world's future depends on my being successful. The symbiosis of family to neighborhood, neighborhood to city, city to state, state to nation, and nation to world relies on me, us, as organizers. Subjectively, I organize because my own mother, sisters, brothers, children have no hope of inheriting a good world unless we succeed." He wrote this probably 20 years ago, and I don't think anything has changed. If anything, it's more so true today than it was then. Our survival, our children's survival, the person sitting next to you, our survival depends on all of us, whether you work for a labor union or you're just sitting here today, getting out there and organizing. And it is not something that you have to have a job to do. It is making a phone call, knocking doors, getting involved in your community. And I believe, just based on looking through today's order of events, that it's something that you guys have all become very good at. And so I just want to thank you for being organizers in your own way and for giving me the opportunity to be here today to speak. Thank you.